Okay, so we have a topic which hopefully we won't finish today, because if we finish today, it means that we will not have seen the vast majority of the sources here. And needless to say, the issue or the topic of abortion has become, in the last, and with certain degrees, 50 to 100 years, one of the issues which represent an increasing awareness of people's personal autonomy, which arguably is a concept that didn't exist 200, 300, 400 years ago, that an individual would have spoken about their personal autonomy, people would have looked at them like, what are you talking about? What personal autonomy? And I think that there were years in America where this was a contentious enough topic whereby literally American elections of presidents could have been determined by their position over here. And I think also, as most of us are aware, it's also a topic which has been supported very, very vocally on both sides, or there becomes almost where there are only two sides of the argument. And one side is identified with the religious position. And Judaism, I think, sort of falls in somehow. I'm not saying this is good or bad right now. I will soon. But I think that in people's minds, it sort of slips into somehow that religion is pretty similar, so therefore if the church looks at it one way, then maybe Judaism should look at it the same way, and obviously that's not the case. Now, after having said all that, and clearly if I really wanted to, or if I really thought it was necessary, and I don't think it is, then I could have gone into a long introduction in terms of the various opinions which exist and where they come from, outside of the Jewish attitude, and I'm not going to do that. But what I will say about the Jewish attitude is that it is nowhere nearly as monolithic as certain people may suspect. I'll say that in simpler English, there is not one Jewish approach to this. And moreover, the range of opinions which you will find are so vast, I find it hard to think of any other topic where you can find opinions literally from, you know, one extreme to the other extreme, and all of them coexisting at the same time in the same places, where there are people who look at this issue again with such diverse perspectives. Now, the reason for this, because it's not just a philosophical issue, the reason for this is partially a textual issue. And that is, there is no primary source which has a detailed, in-depth discussion about abortion in Jewish sources. There is no such source. I'm not going to say now there are no sources that discuss it, because if that would be the case, then you would not have 10 pages in front of you. But part of the reason why you do have so much discussion is because I decided over here to selectively quote some Shelot and Tshuvot. And they go in great depth. And just for example, I have one over here, which is source 15, which is Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. Now, even though you have two full sides of this, right, at least, it goes on from the top of page 7 through 8 through part of 9, you may or may not realize that I selectively cut out the vast majority of his discussion over here. And if you go down to the bottom of page, if you look at page 8, you'll notice every now and then a paragraph begins. There's one lamed tet, there's one mem. Towards the bottom is mem gimel. That's chapter mem gimel within his discussion. I skipped most of the first 40 of them. So over here, what you have is just an incredible amount of, and here's a man that I believe is temporary to most of the people in this room because he was born in 1885 and he died in 1966, which means most of us have overlapped with him, and we will know people that he corresponded with. So, again, he's known as the Sri Deyesh, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. But what's interesting is that the man can go on for so much discussion. If this really were black and white, you know, then this should be very, very simple. It's either yes or it's no, and then move on. And apparently that's not the case. Not to say that there aren't certain people who do think it's black and white. So, with the lack of any real sources, what we're going to do is look at the sources that do exist. And what I am going to start with, admittedly, will lead us in a certain direction. I'm not going to tell you that there isn't a different direction that I could have started, but that's what I want you to hear right now. There are different, and I'll even make it easier for you. The range of opinions that we find range from those who will consider an abortion to be under normal circumstances, when I say normal circumstances, where there's nothing extraordinary taking place, where there's no one life is in danger, you're talking about simply personal choice. You will have opinions that are telling you that that is a Torah law is being broken, and the Torah law which is being broken is one of the Ten Commandments, and that the particular commandment is lo tiritzach, do not murder. Okay, so you will find very nice rabbis who will be of the opinion that abortion is murder. Now, if that were the whole issue, as I said, this could be a very easy discussion, but even to try to prove that point, which I will today, but even to try to prove that point, you're going to see how hard I'm going to have to work to try to prove it. It's not as easy as you would have thought. But afterwards, you'll find people who are going to say, again, not they don't come out and say, well, look how hard you had to work. What they'll just say is they're not all that convinced. Because anytime you have to work really hard to prove any point, you're going to be open for attack in all kinds of steps along the way. So there will be people who absolutely will not be convinced by it, and those who will say, well, you know what, I'm not convinced that there is a Torah law going on here, and some will say, well, maybe it's a rabbinic law. Some will say it's murder, but it's a step down from murder. Some say maybe it's even two steps down from murder. Some, if you really want to go to the other extreme, you will find people who will end up saying that an abortion is no different from birth control. Both of them are stopping a life from coming into the world, and there is no. And I'm not talking about people who will be taking a very, very strict attitude towards birth control. People who will say that there are certain times birth control can be used, and therefore, why should this be any different? Which means, now you can all argue with me right now, why should it be any different? But I'm just saying that for you to realize how extreme the divergence of opinions are. And I don't know how you can get much further from that, from somebody saying, well, I think it's the same as birth control, to somebody telling you that this is murder. There's obviously an incredible range in between that. And it's so wide that when you see some of the people who take one position, considering those who took a different position, they look at them like they're out of their minds. They have no idea what they're talking about. So you're also going to have a level of argument that takes place over here, which sometimes we're somewhat unaccustomed to. On top of all that, when I said before, what if all things were equal, but when are all things ever equal? So then we get to deal with all the cases which are unequal. So for example, you'll have situations which will be easier situations, which we're going to start with, easier at least in theory, not necessarily in practice, such as where the woman's life is in danger and how that is negotiated with, ranging to cases which will be, what if her life is not in danger physically, what if it's emotionally, what if it's psychological, what if she's a victim of rape, what if victim of incest, what if she had an affair, what if she had an affair and she's embarrassed, what if she had an affair and this is going to be devastating upon her life, or again, are all of these reasons for abortion, but you'll find, thank God, all of these cases discussed because all of these cases happened. Yes. Already? Again.
This is a general question. Such a range of opinions, so how do you ever get a halachic opinion that holds or that is accepted to the extent that people recognize it and sets precedent?
It's a very good question, which means I would then have to go, let's say, to Rav Moshe Feinstein, who believed it was murder. No question, this is an act of murder. Rav Moshe also, by the way, and again, I hope to look at this inside as well, he also said that we live in a time that people have this attitude that it's just a question of choice, And he says, therefore, in this generation, we should be even stricter than we were in other generations. So he is dealing against laws which are changing. And I think if you'd ask him, he would probably say, well, it's just simply that's the way I understand it. And it comes back to something which is not different from any other topic in halacha. And I said this happens to be more difficult, but it's any other topic of halacha. If a person is a real posek sees all of Shas at once. I don't want to exaggerate at all. I'm not saying that every single posek has photographic memory of every single, but it's somebody who's, instead of you look up one source and you have a very narrow picture, or you see one tree instead of an entire forest, will be somebody who sees the entire forest and he knows what weight to give to things. Now, it could very well be that he will give more weight to one than to the other because that's the way that he sees the issue in total. It could be that others will see other arguments along the way and say, no, this is the important one, and come to a different conclusion. Is there subjectivity involved over here? Obviously.
Do you go to the posek of your generation, then, who can see what's going on with you? I mean, is Moshe Feinstein still the posek of our generation? I mean,
these are larger issues which have nothing to do...
Well,
one second. These are larger issues that have nothing to do with abortion. They have to do with any halacha issue. So therefore, we all know that if there was some kind of heter that Rav Moshe gave, a lot of people saying, well, Rav Moshe said it's allowed. You know, why shouldn't we allow it? And on the other hand, there are certain heterim that Rav Moshe gave that after he died, people tried to move away from it. I can't tell you that Rav Moshe is still the posek for the generation. What I can say in terms of the previous generation, he was probably the most important posek, and his influence is still felt. And he's certainly somebody that can be relied upon. Now, with the fear of contradicting myself, can we rely on him? Yeah. What should a person do? Theoretically, as somebody just now added in, everybody should have a rav. But let's face it, when it comes to issues like this, not every rav is going to be able to deal with every question, because not every rav is going to feel comfortable dealing with these really big, potentially life and death situation, so then you have to deal with. That's why I use the word posek and I need to use the word rabbi. Over here, it needs to go to somebody who has a broader type of perspective. Now, will that person who has the broader type of perspective, will he necessarily say, this is my opinion and this is what you must do? That's a real good question. I mean, again, if you want me to skip to punchlines already.
Or will a rabbi be able to say, this is where I end, we need to take this to somebody.
No, it's even better than that. Even better than that, yeah.
Didn't Rav Moshe answer specific questions that would not necessarily apply to other questions? The situations are all different.
Yeah, except once he publishes his answers to the questions, then that also becomes law. Let me read you something, because you guys don't want to learn the details. You want to jump straight to all the conclusions. You look at the last page. This is something that I scanned in. You have this on the last page? It says, Mi Pnini Rabbeinu Kuntris Be'inyunei Psak Halacha, which is really a meta-halachic issue, because you're saying, maybe meta is the wrong word. It's not dealing with a particular issue, a micro issue. It's macro-halacha issues. How do you do Psak Halacha? So this is being written by Rav Herschel Schechter from YU, and he's writing about Rabbi Soloveitchik. And what he is writing over here is something which I've told you in the past, and that is that Rabbi Soloveitchik would not always give an answer based upon what he felt was the case, which means he was very, very careful to answer depending how the person asked. And so this could be very frustrating and definitely very, very confusing. Which means if he felt somebody was asking him or saying to him, Rabbi, I consider myself your student. I'm bound up in your approach to halacha. Tell me what you believe to be the halacha over here. He would give one answer. If somebody walked in with a more generic, what does Judaism say about this? Then he was very often would say, Who am I to say that I represent Judaism? Who am I to say that my approach is the only approach? And he then sometimes would say a more normative approach or more popular approach or more lenient approach than he actually believed. So how exactly do you negotiate this? This caused lots of confusion because one person would walk out saying, Rabbi Soloveitchik said this to me. Somebody else would walk out saying, Rabbi Soloveitchik said this to me. And people would say, well, how could this be? He contradicted himself. Yes, he contradicted himself all the time. But I'm telling you, again, how I understand it, and this is also based upon a conversation that I had with Rav Lichtenstein. A couple of years ago, somebody published a book about tzniut, and in the book was an article about covering the hair for women. And somebody there wrote, and it's long been rumored, Rabbi Soloveitchik would tell women they didn't have to cover their hair. Now, I'll tell you a secret about this. If you want to study this, I'll be very happy to teach this topic as well. But Rabbi Soloveitchik, it's very well known, his wife did not cover her hair. So a book review of that book came out in the Post, and in the Jerusalem Post, and said, you know, now we finally have confirmation for the rumors that Rabbi Soloveitchik would tell women that was against this halacha and said women didn't have to cover their hair. So as luck would have it, that was in Friday's Post, this review, and Saturday night I was on a plane, I had a flight, and all ready to catch at least two movies and whatever, and who sits next to me? Rabbi Lichtenstein sits next to me. So there go the movies, there go everything. And I asked him if he saw the review. He said no. I said, you know, do you think someone should respond to this? Now, I happen to know, as my mother can tell you, that my father asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, before he got married, if it's a halacha that a woman has to cover her hair. So guess what he answered? He said, yes, absolutely. And then my father started walking away, and he called him back, and he said, but it's the woman's mitzvah, not the man's mitzvah. And you can't force her to do it, it's her mitzvah to do.
But he said it was no coercion.
No coercion. Sorry. I'm trying to speak to my audience. No coercion. So I said to Rav Lichtenstein, okay, I know, again, I'm going to say firsthand, I know from my father that's what he said. And so he smiled and he said, no. I said, so obviously what I was quoting, he was misquoting. He goes, no, he definitely said both. I said, why would you say that? He goes, no, that's the way that he was. That if he felt somebody was a student of his and wanted to know what he believed, then he would give one answer. If he felt that somebody, on the other hand, just wanted to know what the range of opinions were, then he would very likely give a different answer. And depending who asked, how they asked, who they were, would be all, he'd give completely different answers. Now, isn't that terribly frustrating? Because again, till today, people are going to tell you, oh, Rabbi Soloveitchik said this. But you know what? He did not sit down and write most of his psakim because every single situation was absolutely different. Other people, other poskim are much more predictable and much more consistent. So as I said, if you want to skip to the very end of 10 pages, so we'll do it. Rav Schechter writes, and he over here described what I just now described with Rabbi Soloveitchik with another case, and that was his attitude, that he would give different answers to different people. Uka'enza shamati shapam haita isha mivugeret ba'alat tshuva. Mivugeret, by the way, he goes, I heard that there was once a woman who was getting on in years, who was a ba'alat tshuva. Getting on in years over here is probably in the mid-40s. Sha'ad shehitzlicha lehishtadech, till she finally succeeded in getting married, chalfu avru aleha kama shanim, many years went by, va'ad shenit abra gam kin avru kama shanim, until she became pregnant, some time went on as well, uke'et hine shama meharofe sha'al pi bedikatav, hitbarer sha'ubra yulad bimum chamur ma'od. So now she found out that the fetus that she was carrying had severe deformities. Or disease, boom, boom. And this woman wanted to have an abortion. America, al et pi hagon Rav Shlomo Zalman Orabach. And a physician in America who was a religious man called Rav Shlomo Zalman Orabach and asked him what he thought. Hagon hishivu halok far yadat et da'ati b'nosei hazeh. Rav Shlomo Zalman said, I don't know why you're asking me. You know my approach on this. You know, they'd known one another. There is no way to allow an abortion in such a case. Now, I can already tell you the end of the beginning of the story. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is one of the opinions that having an abortion under any circumstance is murder. And the only time that it could be allowed is to save the mother's life. And that's something that we'll, that hopefully we'll still see today. But you also know that there are other opinions. I was told of another story of a girl, also of a Ba'alat Tshuva, who was learning in one of the seminaries over here. And she was learning for 2, 3, 4 months, and she became absolutely religious during this time. And then she realized that she was 4 months pregnant. The seeds of her previous wild life had now, how do you finish that? Blossomed. And she had a conflict, and she called the rabbi in America, who was the first rabbi that she had, and he said, no, there are opinions that this will destroy your, meaning it's hard enough to being a Ba'alat Tshuva, being an unwed mother Ba'alat Tshuva will be even more difficult for you, and therefore he gave her a lenient opinion, which we're going to have to understand where that comes from, and said, no, you can have an abortion in such a case. Her teachers in the seminary she found out about this and were outraged that anybody can say such a thing, and went through and took her to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, no, an abortion in such a case is murder. She said, I went to my rabbi. And he said, he stopped mid-tracks and he said, well, if that's what your rabbi said, you have every right to listen to him. Because you listen to your rabbi, you have every right to listen to him. I personally think it's murder. And I'll help you and I'll find a place to raise the baby. We'll find a place for you to go for the next couple of months and on and on and on and try to convince her. At the end, he did not succeed and she had the abortion. But Rav Shlomo Zalman said, okay, there's another opinion, but he still said, I believe it's murder. Yes?
Would he say it was murder if, as we can tell these days, there's no way that a child would be viable when born?
Yes, yes, most likely. If the child's not viable, you know, if it's still alive, he would say it's murder, because he would consider a fetus to be alive. Again, we don't know why yet, but that is the case. When we proceed here a little bit more in this thing, he writes, "She'en b'zeh makom lahatir." Chazar v'sha'alo harofe, the doctor comes in and asks, "Od hapam, al kol arichat ha'sipur." He goes and tells the whole story. Eich sheshata tchakdola hizo. This is really an extreme situation. Shabala tshuvahi, that she's a bala tshuva, and it took her so v'chule. And he goes, which this part of the story is called emotional blackmail. He goes and he tells the whole background to the story. V'ulai b'shat hadchak, perhaps in an extreme situation, b'zeh yesh makom ulai letzaded leheter, maybe all this will help to find some kind of a heter. Anohu Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, heich shayach lahakel b'shat hadchak al davashu isur barur. How could something of an extreme situation help you when something is absolutely prohibited? Chazar hala v'ta'an, Od hapam, this guy came back and said again, "V'halo bala tshuva hi ha'isha," but she's a bala tshuva, and we have to have compassion, and we have to strengthen her. "V'ulai al kol panim yesh kan tzad kula," maybe nonetheless there's some kind of leniency. "V'ulai kedai li letalfein el kvodo harav l'machar b'shazu," and he says, "Maybe I'll call back tomorrow, and you'll have time to think about it." "Ulai meshach hayom tira ezet tzad lahakel," and maybe over the time, overnight, you'll find some reason to be lenient. A nahar of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, nu, tov yet kedverecha, titafein lemachar, as you wish, call me tomorrow. Achar avur hayom chazar v'tofein elav harofe, the next day the doctor called back, v'omolei hagon zichrona levercha, Rav Shlomo Zalman said, tagid le'isha, tell the woman, sheyesh posek mefursam v'yerushalayim, tell her that there's a very, very great posek in Jerusalem, b'shem Harav Waldenberg, shematir atapala bidan shala, who would allow an abortion in this case. V'lo tagid lo afilu she'ani cholek b'davar, and don't tell her that I disagree. Shrei isha zu einena metalmidai, she's not one of my students, she took for el harot sheli, that she should have to listen to what I say. What does my opinion have to do with her? She didn't ask me a question. She wants to know if Judaism allows it in such a case. Tell her that there's a great rabbi. Now, I have to stress this. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach believed it was murder. This is better than the story that I told you before, where he said, I believe it's murder. You have a right to listen to your rabbi. Here, he says, I believe it's murder, but she's not asking me. She wants to know what Judaism says. Okay, there is an approach in Judaism that says it's allowed in this case. And by the way, if you've heard stories about Rav Shlomo Zalman, I don't know how you can possibly, have you probably could, but again, this tells you about the man, about his own humility, about his own approach to halacha. You know, for all that lots of people like to say, Eilu ve'eilu divrei lekim chayim, like these, he believes it. He believes it to the extent that even though he thinks the other opinion is wrong, he's still respectful and believes it's part of Torah and can be utilized. Even though, again, what was his quandary? He would not tell somebody, this is what I think you should do. Why not? It's not his opinion. He thinks it's wrong. And every single posek is bound to say what they believe to be is true. So again, if you asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, you asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, you asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, all of them will tell you that they believe that abortion is murder. Is there another opinion? Yes, there's another opinion. Okay. Let's now understand the background for the first opinion, and then hopefully next week we'll figure out the background for the other opinion. Yes?
When you say pikuach nefesh, is it pikuach nefesh at the point that the mother will die right now, or that she could die? Where do you draw the line?
As far as I know, every case of pikuach nefesh in the Torah is in reality not pikuach nefesh. That every case in the Torah is potential pikuach nefesh. If you want to break Shabbat, you do not have to wait for the moment that you're going to die. God forbid. As long as there's a potential for death, and I'm saying a reasonable potential for death, there's a potential for death, that's considered pikuach nefesh, and that's where certain laws come in. So I don't believe that I need absolute 100% proof that this woman will die. I think that her life is in danger is what we call pikuach nefesh. Okay, and again, the same thing in terms of Shabbat. Somebody was when the war broke out, so there were people who were brought up on Shabbat, and there were certain people who were very upset, and they said no, they could have waited till after Shabbat to bring up the soldiers. And I said, I asked the person who said this to me. I said, do you believe that there was a potential pikuach nefesh over? Not, they said no, there was no pikuach nefesh. They could have waited. I said, was there a potential pikuach nefesh? Again, the other side was shooting missiles before we went in. Moving in, could have it potentially have said, is there a potential pikuach nefesh here? They said, yeah, of course there is. So therefore, potential pikuach nefesh breaks Shabbat. You don't have to wait for the situation to be clear and immediate, you know, life and death situation. The potential is enough of a reason that you break Shabbat. Okay. The first source is an extreme source. It's a Mishnah in Ohalot. Ohalot deals with Tuma and Tahara, the law of Ki Yamut Ish. When a person dies in a house, in an ohel, so it's dealing with Tuma and Tara, and along the way, and Tuma Tmeit will obviously be the Aviyah Vota Tuma, and along the way here, we get to a Mishnah of a woman who is extremely pregnant, but in extreme distress. Ha'isha shehi maksha leled, and let me remind you of something. Despite the fact that you call cesarean operations a cesarean, cesarean operations were not necessarily successful in the olden days. Do we all appreciate why? Or we don't? No, the woman would die. 100%. A cesarean would only work if you're killing the mother along the way. And by the way, the problem of a pregnant woman dying or a woman dying at the end of term was an extreme problem, and the archu vote that deal with is, what if the woman's already died, but the baby's still moving around, now what do you do? Again, they knew that you could perform an operation. But if the woman's already dead, the odds of the baby having suffered at least brain damage and maybe more is extremely high. But I'm just telling you that when you read a case like this, you can say, hold it, what are they talking about? You can just do a cesarean. Sorry. Cesarean was a wonderful option if you wanted to kill the mother and you only wanted to save the baby. Aisha shehi makshe leled, a woman's having difficulty giving birth. The Mishnah says, Michatchin et havlad b'meyeha umotzin oto evarim evarim. I'm sorry that this is somewhat graphic. It says you are permitted, or you should, or you must cut the baby into pieces and remove the baby piece by piece. Why? Mipnei shechayeh hakod min lechayav. For the mother's life takes precedence over the child's life. By the way, those in America who are against abortion, they are even, the religious extreme, are even against an abortion when the mother's life is in danger, and this is for theological reasons, which I think are absolutely evil. The rationale is the mother already had a chance to be baptized and could have been saved, but now the baby's soul needs to be saved, so the hell with the mother, we need to baptize and save the baby. Yeah. I don't want to but it comes from very evil theology, which assumes that all people, the default is that we all need to be saved. It means the default is that everybody is stained by sin and therefore you need to be saved. If you didn't believe that you were stained by sin, you don't need to be saved. So over here, once you take this to the extreme, okay, so now we have to save the baby. Okay, as I said, who cares about the mother? Now, so already I can tell you where Judaism, in such a case, would say no. Mother's life is in danger. Mother's life takes precedence, which means, let me phrase it this way, that the existing life takes precedence over the potential life. Now, you could tell me that, why am I saying that? So let's proceed a little bit. So far, maybe I'll even say it in simpler terms. I'll say what the Mishnah says. The mother's life takes precedence over the fetus. Okay, that's all that we know. Mother over the fetus. And it says that, Shechayeha kodmin l'chayav, which means the Mishnah made a value judgment and said, the mother's life takes precedence over the fetus. Yotza rubo, if most of the baby came out, ein no ginbo, then you're not permitted to touch it. She'ein docha nefesh mipnei nefesh. At that point, you're not allowed to decide that this life is more important than that life. So there's a couple of interesting things here that we, in terms of implication. One is that the fetus is apparently not considered a nefesh until it comes out. Because the rationale at the end of the day was, she'ein docha nefesh mipnei nefesh. You don't choose one life over the other life. So if that's the case, then why, in the earlier stage, was I allowed to even cut the baby or the fetus into pieces? So presumably it's not a life yet. On the other hand, it does say, Shechayeha kodmin l'chayav, her life takes precedence over his life. So why is it considered to be a life at that point? So apparently it is considered a life, but it's not considered an nefesh. That would seem to be the result of the analysis of this Mishnah. Now let me make a general observation. What the Mishnah does. Generally in the Mishnah and the Gemara, when you want to teach a law, you will look for the most extreme case, because then all the cases which are easier than that would be included within the extreme. So over here in this case, the Mishnah chose an example where mother's life is in danger, and I'll add one word in that was not here in the Mishnah. Even at the end of the ninth month, would it be an easier choice at the end of the seventh month, fifth month, third month, second month? Presumably, every single stage there would be easier. For had the Mishnah said it the other way around, had the Mishnah said that a woman in her third month and her life is in danger, then you could do it. Then you could say, okay, maybe the third month, yes, but who knows about the ninth month? So the Mishnah will always choose the most inclusive case, because then it's going to easily include all the other cases. And that's why I had to take something which was so graphic, because it means even at the end of the ninth month, and unfortunately, I would assume that there are, I don't know statistics in terms of giving birth, but I would assume a certain percentage of births, there are trouble can take place. Modern science has been able to help with lots of those cases. I mean, having a sonogram to know which way that the baby is presented, again, all kinds of things can take place, but there are certain births which are very, very difficult to take place, and we know that the mortality of mothers was again, this was one of...
Cesareans don't kill people anymore.
Excuse me. So I'm saying that's, and that's today.
Usually.
That's today.
Usually. But I think if a mother dies, I may be wrong, it's just off the top of my head, it's usually sort of for hemorrhaging after the baby's been born, not in the process.
No, that's correct, but I'm saying there aren't cases where there's a hard time for the baby to come out. I mean, and then labors go on and on and on. And at that point, at some point, the mother can get into distress. Okay, and the fetus generally does as well. The Gemara in Sanhedrin introduces this Mishnah as part of a completely different discussion. And if it weren't for the fact that Rashi over here explains the Mishnah in the commentary to the Gemara in Sanhedrin, we probably wouldn't go here, except for one important fact, and that is that the Rambam now will take the Gemara in Sanhedrin and use it as his basic formula to understand the law of abortion. So let's understand what Sanhedrin was talking about. Amar of Huna, katan harodef nitin latzila benafsho. So there's a couple terms that we need to understand over here. The primary one is a term called rodef. Now rodef has become in recent years a very popular term and used, misused. What exactly is a rodef? The word itself means a pursuer, somebody who is chasing somebody else. The Mishnah will tell us, in Sanhedrin, right around the same page, will tell us that if somebody is chasing somebody else to kill them, a good Samaritan standing on the side is obligated to get involved and to save the victim, even at the price of killing the rodef, the perpetrator, the pursuer, which means we all know that there is a law that of self-defense. Hashkem lahargo, somebody comes to attack you, you are permitted to defend yourself. The law of self-defense, with some slight variations, also applies by extension to someone else. I am allowed to defend somebody else who is being pursued. That is the law of a rodef. This Gemara over here raised a very interesting question. And in order to understand this, let me give you a one-minute analysis of the halacha in terms of philosophy. When you get involved in this case and you defend the victim and kill the perpetrator, are you right now acting as a police officer and therefore keeping the peace? Or are you acting as a judge and jury and giving the person his punishment? Now, you don't have to give me an answer to this because I know the answer. What's the answer? It's machloket, like everything else. It's machloket. There is a difference of opinion over here. What exactly is the reason that you are allowed to save him? Is it that it's like the police and their job is to save people, or is it because the guy is getting punished for what he did? Now, with that in mind, and we read this part of the Gemara now, Amar Rav Huna katan harodef nitan latzila benafsho. Rav Huna says that, let's say there's a katan. What does a katan mean? Somebody under the age of 13. Somebody under the age of 13, a judge and jury would not give him a punishment. Why not? Because he's a minor. But a police officer would shoot him to prevent him from killing someone else. So when Rav Huna says over here that if there's a katan pursuing someone to kill him, do I say to the victim, listen, sorry, he's under 13, I can't do anything? Or do you say, no, this person, I'm allowed to save the victim? So Rav Huna says you're allowed to save the victim. So what now can we assume is Rav Huna's approach? He's looking at this person and he's saying that this is not a question of punishment, it's a question of protection. Amar Rav Huna, katan harodef nitan latzila benafsho, kasavar. The Gemara says it must be that he believes, rodef einu tzarech hatra'ah. He goes, this must therefore mean that when you see a rodef, you don't have to warn them. We know that in terms of anybody getting a punishment by a court, you need to stop them and say, you know how to do this. Jewish law says you can't do this, and the person has to accept they're being warned. But that is the law of a court. That's not the law of the police. The police don't have to warn them and open up a chumash and start telling them something. That's only later on for the court system to be able to punish someone. So therefore, he says, a rodef doesn't need hatra'ah. Lo shna gadol v'lo shna katan. It doesn't make a difference because this idea of the Good Samaritan is not acting as a judge and jury, right? He's not a vigilante who's acting as a judge and jury. What is he doing? He's a Good Samaritan who's protecting the individual. Eitz ve'Rav Chista l'Rav Huna. Rav Chista asked the following question then of Rav Huna, and he comes back to our Mishnah with one slight variation. Yotza rosho ein noginbo. If the kid's head came out, you don't touch him. Now, what did the Mishnah say? Yotze rubo. So either he had a different girsa, and the word that he had in his Mishnah was rosho instead of rubo, or it's possible that how do you look at rov? Is rov in terms of quality? Is it quality or okay? Right. Accept it, but also is it quality or quantity? So it could be that if the whole leg is out, that doesn't mean and I measure. No, it means that rubo is in terms of the most of the kid is out, that is the head. So it says, Yatza Rosho, Eino Ginbo, then you're not allowed to touch it. Lafisha Ein Dochin Nefesh Mipnei Nefesh. Because you are not permitted to choose one life over the other life. Va'amai, why not? Rodef Hu. Isn't the fetus considered to be a Rodef? Now, I use the word fetus here, perhaps I shouldn't, because he's not talking about the case of fetus, he's talking about the case where already it's partially born. Once it's partially born, what do we say? That till the kid, when the kid is a fetus, her life takes precedence. It's saying, but even if it's coming out, isn't this a case of where this baby is already ruining his mother's life? Most wait till a little bit later. Is already ruining his mother's life, and therefore we should be able to kill the baby to save the mother. I know the implications of this. You want the car? No, right? Okay. So the Gemara then answers and says, no, Shani Hatam, it's different in such a case, Dimishmaya Karadfila, because from heaven she is being pursued. Which means it seems to be saying the baby's not a pursuer. What does a pursuer mean? A pursuer means that somebody takes a conscious decision. He goes, no, this is almost like a natural process, and this is God put her in this situation, not the fetus or the baby. And no. Let's look at Rashi's interpretation. Source 3. Yotza Rosho, if the head came out. So Rashi gives us background, which you already know. Yotza Rosho, be'isha hamakshe leleid umisukenet. By a woman who's having difficulty giving birth and she's in danger. Misukenet means she's in danger. Sakana. Uktani Resha, the first part of the Mishnah said, Hachaya poshetet yada, the midwife is allowed to put her hand in vichotcho umitziyato la'ivarim and cut the fetus into pieces. De kol zman shelo yatzala avir ha'olam, lav nefeshu. So here Rashi says what we had understood. Rashi says it very clearly. For the whole time that the baby has not come out to the world, he's not considered to be a nefesh. V'nitin lahargo ulahatzil etimo, and you're allowed to kill him to save the mother. Aval yatsa rosho, but once the head came out, ein nogin bo lahargo, you're not allowed to touch him to kill him. The havale ki alud, because he's as if he's been born at that point. V'ein doch a nefesh mipnei nefesh, and then you are not permitted to kill one life to save another life. Based on everything we've seen till now, what do we know about abortion? What do we know? We know that it's permitted in certain circumstances, but do we know if it's prohibited and why it would be prohibited? Do we know that? We know that it's permitted in certain cases. What's the case it's permitted? When the mother's life is in danger. And he right. That's why it's called abortion and not.
It's not really breathing until it's all out. Right.
Okay. But it's interesting. It didn't use the breathing as the criteria. La'avir ha'olam. That's why you're thinking. No, it says till he comes out. La'avir ha'olam. Till he comes out to the world, to the atmosphere. It didn't mean to start breathing.
In theory, if the baby came out and they didn't, I don't know. Wouldn't it die? Does it breathe? I'm only at C-sections. I don't know.
I don't know. I know. Anyway, I don't know what to tell you, but that's not the issue here. Right. The question here is what's considered alive, which means prior to the baby coming out, what did Rashi tell us, which we inferred as well from the Mishnah. What does Rashi tell us? That it's somehow not a nefesh. Now, what exactly is a nefesh? We're not sure. I called it before potential life, not actual life. But it's saying that it's not exactly a complete life. What do we know? We know that there are times that Judaism would say abortion is permitted. What would be the case that abortion is permitted if the mother's life is in danger? What don't we know? We don't know if the mother's life is not in danger, what the prohibition is. That we don't know. Why don't we know that? Because there's no source in the Gemara that tells us, which means what we would very much like for there to be a Gemara that says, is one permitted to kill a fetus. And one rabbi says, no, absolutely not. Why? It says, lo tirtzach. Lo tirtzach means don't commit murder, and murder is any potential life as well. Even there is no Gemara like that. Where there's no back and forth, there's no debate, which means if there was, that would save us of a lot of trouble, but there is no debate. There are cases like this, there's a couple more like this, which discusses abortion, tells us even certain cases allowed, but it doesn't give us enough information to be able to draw the proper conclusion. Let's look at the Rambam. Source 4. The Rambam, very notably, is in the laws of Hilchot Rotzeach Ushmirat Nefesh, the laws of murder and preservation of life. Hareza mitzvat lo ta'aseh, there is a negative commandment, thou shalt not, shel alchos al nefesh harodef, to have compassion for a pursuer. Alchos al nefesh harodef.
Do not have compassion.
Right, there's a negative, I said it the other way. There's a negative commandment not to have compassion on a rodef, because it's a lotase, that's why I have to say it that way. You see a rodef, you can't say, oh, but he's so cute. No, there's a victim that he's about to victimize, and you're not allowed to have compassion. So the Rama says that is a negative commandment. Lefichach, and therefore, horu chachamim, and by the way, I can tell you right now that there have been poor forests that have been destroyed because of the way the Rambam wrote this. People writing, as I said, 43 paragraph tshuvot about this. But let's look what he says. Lefichach horu chachamim, therefore the rabbis gave an order, a ruling, sheha ubra shehi makshe leled, a pregnant woman is having a hard time giving birth, mutar lachtoch ha'ubar b'meya, one is permitted to cut up the fetus in utero, bein basam, now the Rambam is showing off as a doctor, bein basam, bein bayad, whether it be with certain medications, whether it be physically, mechanically, neshahu kirodef achareha lahorga, for the fetus is like a rodef who's chasing after her to kill her. The imi shahotzi rosho, once his head comes out, ein nogin bo, you don't touch him, she'ein docha nefesh mifne nefesh, for you don't push one nefesh in front instead of the other, v'zeo tiv'o shalom, and that is the nature of the world, that's the way the world works. The Rambam did something very interesting over here. First of all, you all appreciate that somehow he combined together the Mishnah that we learned in Ohalot together with the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which dealt with Rodev. Does he say what the Gemara said, or does he say something different? What did the Gemara say, and what did the Rambam say? Right. Exactly. So, if you didn't catch that, what the Rambam did is really he flipped the Gemara around. The Gemara said, the question comes up, it's a Mishnah, it's a given, that you're allowed to save the mother when her life is being endangered by the fetus. The Gemara raised the question, what about killing the baby who's already out, who's threatening the mother's life because it's not completely out? Why don't you say that that is threatening the mother's life, so therefore it's a rodef? So what was the answer to the Gemara? No, that's nature. And therefore, it's not the baby, it's nature. The Rambam took this and flipped it around and said, you're not allowed to have compassion on a rodef, and therefore, if a woman is having difficulty giving birth, then you are allowed to kill him because the fetus is a rodef. So again, did the Gemara say this? No, but that's what you're right. You used the right word. That's what the Rambam over here extrapolates from the Gemara. Now, what does this do for us?
But it does more than that.
Yes.
The Gemara is talking about, the Mishnah is talking about before the baby is born.
Right.
And after the baby is born. And the Rambam talking about before the baby is born. The Mishnah says that.
The Mishnah had both cases. The Mishnah had both before the baby is born and after. And said before you can kill the baby, and afterwards the fetus, and afterwards you can't.
But the question of being a rodef is brought up in the Mishnah only after the baby has presented.
In the Gemara, correct.
The Rambam is talking here only about the case where it's not yet born.
No, correct. What the Rambam does is he takes both cases, just like the Gemara did, just like the Mishnah did. The Gemara brought up the question of rodef by baby, not by fetus, and then rejected it. The Rambam took the situation of rodef and he threw it in as explanation for the reason why you're permitted to kill the fetus. Now the question is, what does he gain by this, or what did this do for us, or what are the implications of this? There are those, and the one who wrote about it in the clearest way was a former chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Isser Yehuda Unterman, in an article published years and years ago in a journal called Noam. And he says, it's really quite clear, a couple things. First of all, the Rambam, what's the reason you're allowed to kill the fetus? Because it is a pursuer, because it's a rodef. So what does that mean? That means that if you didn't have the justification of being a rodef, you would not be able to kill. Which means, under normal circumstances, and he adds one more element, which I didn't say yet. Under normal circumstances, can I walk over to someone and kill them? No. What if it's self-defense? Then I can. What if they're trying to kill someone else? Then I can. Which means, by virtue of the fact that the Rambam introduced the justification of rodef in this, is telling you that if it were not rodef, then it would be a situation of murder.
In other words, the Mishnah doesn't say that.
Correct. I told you. The Mishnah doesn't tell us this. The Rambam, by virtue of the fact that the Gemara brings this into the discussion of rodef, he correct, because, and as I said, he teaches this within his section of murder. What Rav Unterman added was one more element to this, and he added in the Kaf HaDimyon. What does he call it? Kirodev. So he said, right? You see the words here? V'bnei shehu kirodev achareha. Why does he say kirodev and not say rodev achareha? So Rav Unterman then claimed that the reason why it's kirodev is because the fetus is not quite alive yet. So therefore, he's only kirodev. And therefore, he took it one more step. If you were to kill a fetus, or in our words, if you were to perform or have an abortion in a case where a person's life was not in danger, Rav Unterman then say that would be a case of kiretzach. Or ki ritzicha. Now, what's the ki over here? What's the kaf adimyon? He introduced a term which is used in the Gemara in Psachim and Daf Kaf Hei. And I want you to believe me here that when I limited this to only 10 pages, there were just so many more things we could have brought in. There's a Gemara in Psachim and Daf Kaf Hei, and it uses a word which some of you will recognize. It's called abizrayhu. Abizrayhu, it's like avezarim. It's things which are like something, or help something, or close to something, but not something, it's accessories. Abizrayhu, we know that there are three things that a person has to give up their life rather than do. The three things are gilei arayot, shfichat dam, avodah zarah. The Gemara is discussing the case of gilei arayot, and says, does a person only have to die for actual gilei arayot? What if it's almost gilei arayot? And the Gemara brings a case where somebody gets a note from his doctor that he's going to die unless he has relations with this particular woman. So what does the Gemara say? Let him drop dead. That's what the Gemara says. Let him die. Why? You can't. So then the Gemara goes, well, what if, okay, he doesn't have relations, he just has to look at her naked. The Gemara says, and the Gemara says, no, this is abizrayu to gilei arayot. It's not gilei arayot itself, it's abizrayu. And the laws, the severity of gilei arayot apply also to abizrayu. That's what the Gemara ends up saying. So the Gemara there also discusses abizrayhu to avodah zarah. For example, what if there are things which are very, very close to doing avodah zarah, but it's not done in the exact way? The Gemara says, no, those are things that are also prohibited because it's close enough. So the Gemara there doesn't discuss a case of abizrayhu to ritzicha. Is there something which... So Rav Unterman says, no, this is abizrayhu to ritzicha. Why is it not actually ritzicha? Because it's not actually a person. So now, it's very possible that in terms of going to court and being tried for murder, one wouldn't be tried for murder, but he's saying that philosophically, religiously, theologically, this is murder, but the only problem is the victim is not a complete victim. There's something lacking in the victim, so therefore it's not a complete victim. And this would all contribute to the more severe approach towards abortion, saying that that abortion is murder, or perhaps some would say it's like murder, and that's why the Rambam introduces it in the cases, in the laws of murder. And what the Rambam therefore is telling us is that only where there's a justification, where there's a life in danger, would it be allowed, just like we learned from the law of rodef. But if there's no justification, it would be murder. Now, Do you all realize, and this is what I said from the very beginning today, did I have to work very hard to try to prove this point? Yeah. And that's why the various steps along the way, there could be people say, hold it. You know, there are holes in this. By the way, you want holes in it. Why does it say Horu Chachamim? Why does it say the rabbi said? So the Rambam could defend himself, because that makes it sound like it's rabbinic. It's not a Torah law. So the Rambam could defend himself and say, the rabbis made the application. It's not a rabbinic law, it's a rabbinic application. But I'm just pointing out over here that even right over here, there is room to debate. I just want to throw in one interesting point as far as the Rambam goes, in terms of using the word kirodef or kamorodef. Ironically, on the same page in the printed Rambam, the laws of Chovil and Mazik end, and the laws of Rotzeach begin. So in my printed Rambam, both of these sources are on the same page. Almost the last law of Chovil and Mazik, if it's not the last one, is the source 5. Sfina shechashva lihishaber, the boat is about to sink, to break because of the weight. Mikoved hamasui, because of the weight on it. Va'amad achad mehen, and somebody on the boat stands up. Va'hakal mimasa, and he lightens the weight of the boat. V'hishlich bayam, patur, and he throws stuff overboard, he's patur, which means we're in a boat together, right? And I say, the boat's going to sink, so I take your bags and I throw it overboard. I don't have to pay you back for it. I'm patur. Shehamasa shaba kimo rodef. The weight of the boat is like a rodef, achareim lahargam. U'mitzvah rab asa lashlich oshim. And he did a big mitzvah to throw it overboard. So here we find the Rambam using the idea of like a rodef by an inanimate object, where there's no intention whatsoever. So a Rambam apparently has this halachic or philosophical category of something endangering people's lives that need to be dealt with, which are not necessarily doing it with a well-thought-out plan, which are still like a rodef. If you want to now argue, what does it mean? Why is it here kimo rodef in there? It's ki rodef. That's getting a little bit too difficult. And I can't. Jane?
Isn't there a discussion, a complicated discussion, of when a life is considered a life? I mean, a collection of cells, if you're 6 weeks pregnant, is different than 9 months. Yeah, I mean,
maybe. Well, the reason,
So again,
I'm going to say maybe, because this whole issue about when a life is a life, going for example, some ICUs, I'm not sure it's still today, but a couple of years ago, literature said some ICUs will prevent the sperm from getting to the egg. Some ICUs will stop the fertilized egg from traveling up the fallopian tubes, which is an abortion. So again, you can check up and say which ICU works in. It's the same thing. Which IUD works in which particular way? So, if there is a problem from the moment of conception, and the moment of conception need not be the moment of intercourse, it could be a little bit later. So is it frustrating the sperm from getting to the egg? Is it frustrating the conceived egg from traveling where it needs to travel? All of these questions are incredibly difficult, and I can assure you that the sources are not clear. You will hear people just throwing out numbers, throwing 40 days out, throwing out things like 3 months, 5 months, 6 months, people throwing out all kinds of things with great confidence. It's not exactly clear. Again, the most famous number that people will throw out is 3 months. Rav Lichtenstein has an article where he says 3 months is 3 months in terms of abortion. There's no source for it whatsoever. 3 months is a source for a woman to know that she's pregnant for certain halachot, but it has nothing to do with abortion, which means knowing you're pregnant may not have anything to do with abortion one way or the other, and why combine them? But other people find it very, very easy to combine these sources together. What did we do today? What didn't we do today? We had an introduction to the topic generally. We are aware now that there are lots of different opinions. We saw the background for one opinion, which is a prominent opinion. I don't want to minimize this by saying, no, that this is not a legitimate, this is As I already told you in passing, this is the opinion that people like, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Soloveitchik, and the list can go on, thought is the proper opinion, and therefore, as far as they were concerned, it would be very rare, if ever, for any of those people to allow an abortion other than the case that we saw in the Mishnah, where a woman's life is in danger. Where things get a little more interesting is then, how do you define danger? How broad is danger? Is danger something also in terms of a cycle of depression, a woman who's suffered from postpartum depression and is pregnant, is that considered to be danger? And I'll tell you that everything we know about that, absolutely, that's considered to be danger. But that's what they would say, and the question is just plugging in all the details to getting to be danger. But on the other hand, where none of them would be lenient would be because the fetus would be damaged in any way. Which is the mother's life is one thing, but if the fetus is going to be damaged, there's no source.
Well, that's psychological
damage. Okay, so then we could debate how severe, and then you'd have to show that the mother's life is actually in danger. Which means for you to come and say this woman has postpartum depression, and if she gets pregnant again, I don't see how she can possibly deal with it. That's one thing, but to say that she's going to have a really hard time to deal with a handicapped kid, that's not going to be a strong argument. As I said, according to this line of reasoning, and they will tell you across the board that they will not allow abortion in those cases, and we'll see some of their arguments inside. But we will also see that there is another side, which some of the other side is so extreme in the other direction that it's that if you never heard it, you will be shocked.
Can I just ask about the
road? You can ask about anything. Right.
Isn't there a sort of situation where what you see is not what's actually happened, that you should say, look, stop it now?
You're correct. You're correct. So let me qualify it and say that the law is a theoretical law. And in order to really know all the details, you better be very careful that you are correct in your knowledge. The other thing about a rodef is that you are by law obligated to use minimal force. And this is one of the differences between a rodef who's threatening someone else versus threatening yourself. If a person is threatened, they themselves are threatened, they are allowed to use maximum force to protect themselves. In terms of Beitin Shamala, Beitin Shamata, Beitin Shamala, God knows everything and knows that you could have used less force, but no court will prosecute somebody, at least I'm talking about Jewish law, if their life is in danger, but they could have used minimal force, but use maximum force, a court's not going to do anything. Because they say, the Rambam writes, because a person's going to be, you know, in shock at that point. One of the commentaries in the Rambam writes that. On the other hand, when you are standing on the side, then it's assumed that you have a little bit more clarity and a little bit more time to think and a little bit more time to deal with it. Then you absolutely have to use minimum force in order to stop the situation. And you could be prosecuted if you use more force than necessary. But as far as your read of the situation, if two little kids are playing cowboys and Indians, and one, you know, and you shoot the Indian because you thought that he was a rodef, so then you may find yourself a lot of quality time by yourself.